Hi everyone, I'm Rabia Chaudhry. You might remember me as Adnan Syed's advocate on Serial or as the host of the hit podcast Undisclosed. And now I am so excited to introduce you to my brand new podcast called Nighty Night, Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. Nighty Night features new adaptations of classic horror stories that you may never have heard of and fictionalized true life stories that are so frightening, you'll start to think that reality is scarier than fiction. So join me as I tuck you into bed with stories that will leave you sleepless all night long. Subscribe to Cast Media's new podcast, Nighty Night, wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and review. Nighty Night, everyone.
Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In April of 2014, students from the University of Calgary were celebrating the end of the school year. A party among friends was being held in a quiet tree-lined street in Brentwood. In the early morning hours, however, a flurry of 911 calls were made from inside the home, reporting that somebody in attendance had unleashed a senseless attack with a knife. It was the 15th of April 2014 when a group of around 20 students from the University of Calgary in Calgary, Canada, had gathered at a home in Butler Crescent in the Brentwood neighbourhood for a party. Everybody who was in attendance had been invited, and they were all there to celebrate the end of the school year. The University of Calgary had a 53-year-old tradition known as Bermuda Short Stay, which was to commemorate the end of term. It was more an intimate party among friends than a big college party filled with complete strangers. According to neighbours, most of the night, the group at the party had sat around a fire pit, drinking some beers and talking about politics and the stock market. At around 9 p.m, they retreated into the house, and as neighbours said, you wouldn't even know that a party was being held. There was no loud music, there was nobody screaming and yelling, and it was really just a nice, quiet gathering among friends. As the rest of the neighbourhood slept peacefully, tragedy would strike. It was around 1:20 a.m. when Calgary police received a flurry of phone calls reporting an incident inside the home. When police arrived at the home where the party was being held, they discovered three deceased men. A woman and another man were found barely clinging to life. They had been rushed to hospital, where they succumbed to their injuries. All five victims had been stabbed to death. After committing the massacre inside the home, the suspect then fled. He was found around 40 minutes later with the help of a police canine. He'd be sent to the hospital where he was treated for a dog bite. He'd be identified as 22-year-old Matthew DeGroot. You can see a photograph of Matthew on the Vodacast app. The shocking murders were the worst mass killing the Calgary had ever seen. Police Chief Rick Hansen held a press conference.
The suspect arrived at the party, obtained a large knife, and targeted the victims one by one, stabbing them several times.
The scene was horrific. It's extremely difficult to go into a scene like that with young people who've been killed, who've been murdered.
Investigators would immediately release some information about the murders. They revealed that at around 1:20 a.m., Matthew had arrived at the party after leaving his job at a grocery store. He was carrying a weapon which they would only describe as an instrument, which he had apparently taken from his work. inside the home where the party was being held. Matthew then grabbed a large kitchen knife and targeted his five victims. He systematically stabbed them, one by one. According to witnesses, there was no altercation or even a verbal interaction before Matthew unleashed the attack. Investigators revealed no motivation, but did say that Matthew had been invited to the party, and he wasn't under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Matthew's father, Douglas DeGrood, was a 33-year veteran of the police service. Following the murders, Chief Hansen said that he had spoken with him and said that he was absolutely devastated and wanted his condolences to be passed to the families of the victims. The murders completely stunned the community, especially those who were students at the University of Calgary. What should have been a celebration had quickly turned into the epitome of a nightmare. University President Elizabeth Cannon released a statement which read, "This is a very shocking and tragic day for our students and our entire university family. Our thoughts and condolences go out to the families of those who have lost their loved ones in this unimaginable and senseless tragedy." The five victims would be identified the following day as 22-year-old Joshua Hunter, 22-year-old Caitlin Perez, 23-year-old Jordan Sakura, 27-year-old Lawrence Hong, and 23-year-old Zachariah Rathwell. You can see photographs of all of the victims on the Photocast app. Zachariah was a first-year student at the Alberta College of Art and Design. Around 3 weeks before the massacre, Zachariah had watched a speech at school of a guest from Norway who spoke about the 2011 Norway attacks. Afterwards, his teacher put a bonus question on the final exam, asking her students what they had taken away from the speech. Zachariah had written, "I took away that even though tragic events cause pain and distress, a truly well thought out memorial can help ease the suffering and build community while not just glazing over and forgetting the past." Just 3 weeks later, Zachariah himself would become the victim of a mass murder. Joshua was a second year account student at the University of Calgary's Haskayne School of Business. A former boss said that he had a $1 million smile and said that it had come in handy when he was working as a valet and bellman at the International Hotel Suites in Calgary. Joshua had left the job to study full-time last year, but he had been planning on coming back in May to work over the summer. Tanya Coleman said, "Everyone was so excited to have him back. I had a uniform ready for him." According to friends of Joshua, he rarely thought of his own needs and was always looking out instead for the best interests of his friends. Joshua and Zachariah were both members of a local band called Zachariah and the Prophets. Zachariah played the guitar and sang lead vocals, while Joshua played drums. They had just celebrated the release of their first album at a weekend show in Calgary. Afterwards, they had posted a message up on Facebook which read, "You guys made our EP release amazing. We love every one of you. Let's be friends." Their friend and bandmate Kyle Tenove would share some fond memories of the pair. He said, "We used to skip school together. We would sneak out so we could practice. Then we get busted and we get suspended. It was the best." The band would reveal that they were going to be disbanding because the band was all four of them. And now there was only two left. You can see a recording of the band playing live on the Votacast app. Jordan worked part-time for McGuinness and Holloway Funeral Home, where he was known as a promising and hard-working employee. Funeral director Ernie Beagle said, "He had the qualities to be a great funeral director. He wanted to serve people. He wanted to be there when they needed him." He said that Jordan was a very compassionate man who always knew exactly what to say to those who were grieving for their loved ones. Ernie said that he was privileged to be organizing Jordan's funeral. While Ernie had a lot of experience with death in his 43 years as a funeral director, he was struggling to deal with the loss of Jordan. Jordan was also majoring in religious studies at the University of Calgary. Caitlin, also known as Kiri, was studying English at Mount Royal University. She had been a keen ballet dancer and had taken dance for several years, a Counterpoint dance academy. Her dance teacher, Shannon Hearn, would say that Kiri's smile and her energy would light up the stage. She described her as a joy to teach and a beautiful person who would be sorely missed. Dancing had been a massive part of Kiri's life. Every weekend she would spend hours at the ballet studio. Her friend, Kiri MacArthur, said, "It always came naturally to her. She did ballet, jazz, lyrical. She worked very, very hard, and I don't think I ever heard her say anything bad about anybody ever." A scholarship called the Kiri Perez Love of Dance Scholarship would be set up in her honour to support children who could not afford to go to dance classes. Lawrence was set to graduate that year from the University of Calgary with a degree in urban studies. He had ambitions of working for the city of Calgary. Lawrence was a proud gay man, which had led to some bullying while in high school. He and his family had moved from the Philippines to Calgary when he was in grade 8. His friends said that he was friendly, funny, and fashionable, and was a regular volunteer at the city's folk music festival, and was the founder of the Calgary Creative City Collaboration, which aimed to boost the presence of arts and culture in the city. In fact, their weekly meetings would be held in the same home where he was murdered. According to friends, you could always depend on Lawrence, no matter how busy he was. His friend, Christy Harris, shared her belief that Lawrence was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She said, "I couldn't imagine anyone wanting to hurt him. Everybody loved him." An afternoon vigil would be held for the victims at the University of Calgary. A candle was projected on the screen in the hall of the university before Elizabeth Cannon, the university president, called for a moment of silence. By this point, a makeshift memorial had appeared in front of the crime scene tape, which surrounded the home where the murders had unfolded. Flowers and trinkets to commemorate the lives of the victims, piled up on the snow-covered street. There were candles, photographs, and even personal mementos, such as ballet slippers as homage to Kiri and a drawing of high school memories for Jordan. You can see a photograph of this on the Photocast app. As the loved ones of the victims began to prepare for their funerals, the community were grasping to contemplate what had taken place and why. The lack of motivation was perplexing to the community, as well as to the investigators. Chief Hansen said on Calgary radio station, CHQR, that when a murder is seemingly completely random and unpredictable, it is extremely unsettling. He said he understood that the community were anxious to have answers, and the investigators were just as anxious to get those answers. Matthew DeGroote had come from an average family and lived in the neighbourhood of Scenic Acres. He had earned a psychology degree from the University of Calgary just the previous year and had been accepted into the school's law program for the fall. He had excelled in school where he was known to be quiet but friendly. Matthew would be charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder but would be transferred to the Southern Alberta Forensic Psychiatry Centre by the court. His defence lawyer, Alan Fay, said that his client was lucid and was doing as well as could be expected given the circumstances. He also said that he couldn't comment on issues of mental illness, but said to his knowledge, there was no indication of any mental illness in the past. He also added that he wasn't exactly sure why Matthew had been transferred, whether it was for a determination of fitness to stand trial, or whether it was for a psychiatric examination. The Calgary Herald would report that just before showing up to the party, Matthew had sent confusing and disjointed text messages to his family. According to an unidentified police officer who knew Matthew's father, Douglas, the family had been worried that Matthew was going to take his own life that night. His mother had called police while his father had gone out searching for him. It was also reported that Matthew had mental health issues in high school. Defence Fay responded to these accusations and said that he had not yet been told about these alleged text messages and had not heard that his client had mental health issues in the past. He said that Matthew's family were not agreeing with certain things that were being reported in the media, but he failed to elaborate any further. Douglas DeGroon, Matthew's father, would speak publicly about the tragedy. Alongside his wife Susan and in front of reporters, he said that he and the rest of the family would give anything to bring the victims back.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming. I am Douglas DeGroon, and I am an inspector with the Calgary Police Service. But I'm here today not as a police officer, but as a parent and a husband. I speak for my wife, Susan DeGroon, as we are one voice. We are shocked and devastated. And we are trying to make sense of what happened. We are deeply saddened for what the families and friends of the victims are going through. Your lives have been turned upside down. We know words cannot begin to ease your pain and suffering. Please accept our deepest condolences and know you are in our hearts, our thoughts, and our prayers. Our condolences also go out to the first responders who attended the scene. You had to detach from your emotions to do your job. Your professionalism was exceptional. Like any parent can tell you, a love for your child is unconditional. And we love Matthew dearly. Our Matthew is a great kid, full of love, kindness, and respect for others. Growing up, he received good grades in school and was active in a variety of sports. As a young adult, he got a part-time job, entered university, and became more involved in the community. He raised funds for charities through his passion for running. He had a bright future ahead of him, as he was about to start law school in the fall. Just like you, we struggle to understand what happened.
He described his son as respectful and intelligent, with good grades and a sports fan. He said that he raised money for charities through his passion for running. According to Douglas, Matthew had a bright future ahead of him. He was attempting to reconcile Matthew's proud past with the actions he now stood accused of. Douglas was suffering from multiple sclerosis and used a cane to walk. His physical struggles paled in comparison to his emotional struggles. As he attempted to hold back tears, he said, "Just like you, we struggle to understand what happened." He told the reporters that they would never recover from what had taken place, but said that the collective support from the community had eased some of their pain. Douglas said, "We hope someday we will have answers as to why this happened. Regardless, it won't bring the victims back, but we would give anything to do just that." In addition to thanking the community for their support, he also offered his condolences to the first responders who attended the scene. The families of the victims would come together and express their tremendous grief and tragedy. The joint statement from the families would be read aloud by Calgary Police. It read in part, "We know the public and media are searching to understand how this could have happened, as are we. But we also know that these answers will take time and nothing will come as quickly as we want or need. As a group, we have come together to support one another, and in time start the healing process. First, we must say goodbye to our loved ones, which includes memorials and funerals over the coming days and weeks. We ask that in this time of unimaginable sorrow, you respect our privacy and give us the breathing room we need to come to grips with what has happened to Josh, Zach, Katie, Jordan, and Lawrence." Since you're listening to Morbidology, I don't doubt that you're a murder mystery fan. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing mobile game, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. June's Journey is set in the 1920s, and has a really glamorous aesthetic and a diverse cast of characters. You get to play as June Parker, an amateur detective investigating the mysterious death of her sister. Each scene in the game will take you through a murder mystery, but along the way you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets. What I love especially about this game is that it's super relaxing and therapeutic. but at the same time, it truly tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I find myself playing this game late at night before I head to bed. So download June's Journey today for free from the Apple App Store or Google Play. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. On the 20th of April, Jordan, Katie and Joshua were laid to rest. Jordan's funeral was the first of the day. McInnes and Holloway, the funeral home where he had worked, were honoured to hold the service. A plain wooden coffin sat at the front, covered in a bouquet of white carnations and white roses. A photo montage played on the screen which depicted Jordan's life. Jada Shrihan, who had been friends with Jordan since high school, stood before the mourners and reassured them that when Jordan died, he wasn't alone. He was surrounded by his friends and people who loved him. As she struggled to hold back tears, she said, "Myself and a couple of friends were with him right at the end, and I want you all to know that Jordan was not alone." She fondly recalled Jordan as a generous and wonderful friend. His brother, Julian, recollected how Jordan was always about integrity and telling the truth. His funeral will be followed by Katie's funeral, which was being held at First Alliance Church. Her family had asked mourners to arrive at the funeral wearing bright colours. Katie was remembered as a dancer, a sister, an artist, and a confidant. Her uncle, Galen Peraz, described Katie as a tiny girl with such courage and revealed that two trees were to be planted in her memory at a Calgary park in the fall. She was also remembered by her aunt, Sandy Koski, who mentioned how Katie could recite the movie Dirty Dancing line by line. A couple of her dance mentors spoke of her ability and spirit and displayed a video montage of her dancing. Her friend Kirsty Berg said to the mourners, "Don't focus on how she was taken away from us. Remember her as she was." Joshua's funeral would be the final one of the day. It was held at Christ Church in the Southwest. Family friend Peter Gamble said, "Josh had moral standards. They were the kind that were quietly demonstrated, like the way he treated everyone around him. He would hang with little children as if they were his old friends. If he was going to a movie with his buddies, he wouldn't hesitate to include his parents. Who does that?" He described him as a fine son, a dedicated brother, an unprecedented friend, and a conscientious citizen. He said, "Josh lived well. He had a new positive impact on all of us." Investigators would announce that a significant part of their investigation was focusing on whether Matthew was suffering from mental illness at the time of the attack. They were also wanting to look into whether there was any kind of communication between Matthew and the victims before the attack unfolded, as well as any communications he had with people before the party, which could give an insight into his state of mind at the time or provide some kind of motivation. Just the day after the first three funerals were held, Matthew was ordered by a judge to undergo psychological assessment to determine whether he was mentally fit to stand trial. The assessment had been requested by prosecutor Stephanie Brown after receiving a letter from psychiatrist Dr. Riley Smith recommending the assessment. Defence Fay announced that he would not be ruling out a defence of not criminally responsible. He acknowledged that the case was going to be tough for everybody, stating, "It's a horrendous case and it's touched so many lives." The next day, Zachariah would be laid to rest. His funeral was held at the Calgary Chapel. Inside, his father Bruce Rathwell told mourners that his son was the poster child for the kind of child every single parent wants. The front of the chapel was a testament to the type of person that Zachariah was. It included three guitars, a Boy Scout uniform, a rugby jersey, jockey equipment, and skates. His parents had also brought along a bronze plaque with Zachariah's hand and footprint as a baby. His mother spoke during the funeral and said, "I love you. As long as I'm living, my baby boy, you'll be." Which was a quote from the children's book, Love You Forever, by Robert Munch. Lawrence would be the final victim to be laid to rest. Around 200 people packed into the Centre Street Church, where his loved ones shared their fond memories of him. His younger brother Miles said that despite the fact his brother had died before finishing his final exam, his life was still rich and full. He said, "It makes me mad that he was taken from us, but that is not the part of his death I want to dwell on. The fact that he didn't finish his journey does not take away from his journey and the life that he led. He lived life, truly lived it." He described how every single person that met Lawrence were in some way or another his friend. His loved ones also painted a portrait of a man who was comfortable in his own skin, an amazing friend and passionate about urban planning as well as sustainable modes of transport. As a tribute to Lawrence, a special bus route, the 430 Lawrence Hong Express, took mourners from the university to the funeral, and all proceeds would be going to the Calgary Fairy Tales Film Festival in his name. David Cooper, Lawrence's longtime university instructor and senior transit planner, told the mourners that Lawrence's openness and courage to simply be himself had taught him a crucial lesson. He said, "He taught me how to be comfortable in my own skin as a gay man." Before the end of the month of May, it was announced that Matthew was fit to stand trial. This simply meant that Matthew could comprehend the legal process and assist in his defence during trial. It was also ordered that Matthew would remain in psychiatric care under a mental health certificate. Outside of court, Defence Faye said, "He remains there until it's determined his mental health no longer requires it. The doctors have determined he needs ongoing treatment. He's obviously worried and apprehensive about what happened and what will happen." He also said that Matthew was gradually coming to terms with the gravity of his actions.
"You have to keep in mind that being fit to stand trial only means that he understands the process and he can instruct counsel. You can still be very profoundly mentally ill and be fit to stand trial. I've visited him on a number of occasions. He's doing as well as can be expected. He's obviously worried and apprehensive about what's happening and what will happen, but you know, other than that, he seems as good as he can be."
Less than a month later, Matthew appeared in court, where this time he would be ordered to undergo a psychiatric assessment to determine if he could be found criminally responsible for the murders. Prosecutor Neil Weiberg said that it was partly in response to the expectation that Matthew's defence would be focusing on his mental health. After the 30 days were up, it was announced that the psychiatric assessment report was still not complete, meaning that there would be delays by another 30 days. When those 30 days were up, Judge Joanne Durant ruled that the results were not being made public and were subject to a publication ban. It was actually Prosecutor Weiberg who had made the application to keep the results private, at least until the media was given the chance to apply to have it made public. In court, he said that the ban was needed to ensure that Matthew had the right to a fair jury trial. A couple of days later, a fundraising concert was held at Jubilee Auditorium, and all of the money raised would be going towards scholarships created in the names of Zachariah, Joshua, Katie, Jordan and Lawrence, as well as towards two non-profit charities, the Guitar Rock Shelter Foundation and the Girls Rock Camp Calgary. In March of the following year, there was a hearing to decide on whether Matthew would be standing trial for the murders. Once again, however, there was a publication ban, meaning that none of the evidence presented would be publicly revealed. But outside of court, Prosecutor Weiberg said that the evidence presented was tough on the packed courtroom. Shortly thereafter, Sergeant Colin Chisholm would speak with the Calgary Sun about the impact the case had on not only the family of the victims and Matthew, but the investigators who had worked on the murder case, and the community as a whole. He said, "You don't see these things. It's very rare that you see a crime of this magnitude." The murder trial would be scheduled for the following year. Justice David Graetz would express concern at the one-year delay, but Defence Fay argued back that this was the earliest date he would be available, and the soonest that the trial could be scheduled. During a hearing to discuss the matter, Defence Fay asked for an out-of-town judge to be assigned to preside over the case. He didn't want there to be any bias by having a local judge who could potentially know Matthew's father, who was a police officer. The request would be granted. Finally, in May of 2016, the murder trial was ready to begin. Before the first day of the trial, Greg Paris, Katie's father, released a statement on behalf of all of the families of the victims. He stood in front of the Calgary Court Centre and was flanked by all of the other family members, many of whom were donning t-shirts with a photograph of their loved ones. He said, "All we ask is that you remember how they lived. Full of purpose, full of life, full of goodness and love for their friends and families. Their deaths in this tragedy do not define them." He said that the past 2 years have been extremely difficult for all of the victims' loved ones, and said that they were all thankful for the overwhelming support that they had been shown by the community. The mass murder trial opened on the 15th of May. At the very beginning of the trial, Matthew admitted, in an agreed statement of facts, that he had stabbed his victims. The statement quoted Matthew as saying to investigators, "I stab people in the house. I just want to say that when I stab them, I tried to do it mercifully. I aimed for their heart. They put up a struggle which made it hard, but so you know, it wasn't sadistic or anything. I didn't enjoy killing at all. I said sorry, but the Son of God was controlling me. What I did may seem atrocious, but I was killing Medusas and werewolves." Prosecutor Wybert revealed that Matthew had been invited to the party by a childhood friend, Brandon McCabe, who had said that Matthew was looking for hidden meanings within certain songs and had made a number of bizarre statements, such as, "Obama was the Antichrist." Prosecutor Wybert said to the courtroom that when Matthew was in the home, he handed his friend a clove of garlic and told him that he may need it. He also handed him a knife which looked like a bread knife with a serrated blade. In the home, he had also put on a pair of latex gloves. During his interview with investigators, Matthew had told them that he felt as though he needed to attack Zachariah before Zachariah attacked him. He grabbed a butcher knife with a 21-centimeter blade from a knife block in the kitchen. Before attending the party, Matthew had been working as a stock clerk at the Crowfoot Safeway store. Andrea Laderette, who worked with Matthew, told investigators that Matthew typically said hello. However, when he arrived at his shift at 2 p.m. before the murders, he said nothing. Andrea noticed that he had purchased a package of garlic capsules. She went to find him later on at around 10 p.m. However, he had already left his shift. He had left an hour early. When she sent him a text message asking where he was going, he replied, "Trust that I never hurt anyone. All will be known. 5. After Matthew arrived at the party and after he handed the garlic and bread knife to Brandon, somebody in attendance saw him throw his cell phone into the fire pit in the backyard. He then smashed it with an axe and threw it against a fence. It was around this time that Brandon and 4 other attendees left the home to go and get some food. They arrived back at around 1:20 a.m. and were met by a bloodbath. As Brandon was approaching the home, he heard a female screaming. Her screams were followed by Joshua running out of the home, with Matthew chasing him with a knife. Brandon chased Matthew and caught up with him. He convinced his friend to drop the knife. Matthew said to him that it was the night of the long knives before he fled from the scene. It was the heroic actions of Brandon which possibly prevented more bloodshed that night. The responding officers found Joshua barely clinging to life in the front lawn. He had been fatally wounded and would die from his injuries at the hospital. Inside, they found Zachariah and Jordan dead, They were lying next to each other on the main floor. Nearby, a friend was desperately attempting to keep Lawrence alive by applying pressure to his wounds as he lay on a couch. Lawrence died there at the scene. Another friend was tending to Katie, who was conscious and bleeding heavily from her wounds. She died at Foothills Hospital, just a few minutes after Joshua. Police would eventually find Matthew, and as he rode in an ambulance, he made a number of statements about killing werewolves, zombies and vampires. The attack had unfolded as the party was winding down for the night. It happened very quickly and unexpectedly, with the victims having very little opportunity to react to what was transpiring. Earlier in the night, Brendan and another friend, Daniel Sieben, had tried to talk some sense into Matthew as he rambled on about things that made no sense. According to Daniel, he had been worried that Matthew had been considering self-harm. He had taken Matthew outside and told him it was okay to admit if he needed help. In fact, Matthew's own parents had wanted him to seek psychiatric help, and on the night of the murders, they too had feared he was going to harm himself and had even contacted police to report their concerns. Their report had tragically come too late, and by the time the phone call was placed to police, Matthew had already unleashed his attack. It was evident from the very beginning of the trial that much of it would focus on Matthew's state of mind at the time of the murders. Prosecutor Weiberg said that despite his mental state at the time of the murders, he had not been under any psychiatric care before the murders. However, he revealed that in the lead up to the murders, he had searched the internet for subjects such as Adolf Hitler and Barack Obama being the Antichrist. He stated, "The accused dominant thought was that the world would end at midnight." The court would hear testimony from Constable Sean McGivory, who was one of the three officers who had tracked Matthew down following the murders. He said that he was surprised that Matthew, who was of slight build, had been able to fend off the three officers and their German Shepherd K9. He stated to the courtroom, "It was almost as if he was levitating off the ground. His body wasn't touching the ground, other than his hands and feet." Defence Frey questioned, "Almost superhuman type strength," to which he replied, "Yes." He said that when he searched Matthew, he found a clove of garlic. When he asked Matthew what the garlic was for, he said it was for vampires. He testified that Matthew had said other peculiar statements, such as, "I'm the son of God," as well as, "I was born in an incubator and I'm an alien." Before testimony was heard on the beginning of day two of the trial, the loved ones of the victims were allowed to pay tribute as Matthew listened. It was an unheard-of opportunity, but it was something that both the Crown and the defence thought was the decent thing to do. At the end of the day, it was evident already that Matthew had admitted to the murders, and the whole trial would hinge on his mental state, as opposed to whether or not he had committed the murders. All of them fondly recalled their loved ones, and emotion in the courtroom ran high. They spoke of first boyfriends, electric guitars, sibling rivalry, and regret. "How can you put into words all the things that a person was?" asked Rhonda Lee Rathwell, the mother of Zachariah, as she told the courtroom not to dwell on the night he was killed, but instead the life he had lived. Miles, Lawrence's brother, said he never thought there would be a tomorrow without his brother, while Joshua's father, Barclay Hunter, recalled how his son would tell them that simple acts of kindness could change the world. Nikki, Katie's sister, said, "Thank you for the opportunity to speak about our loved ones, not as victims, but as people." She went on to describe how her sister despised bad weather, and laughed as she recalled how it got in the way of her love for fashion. Speaking last, Zachariah's father said, "Hopefully, one day we will meet again. Until then, I will never forget the beautiful miracle that you were. Sleep tight, little bear." Throughout all of the statements, Matthew never stopped paying full attention. While Matthew had been invited to the party, it was by a childhood friend. That night was the first night he had ever met any of the victims. 13 parents, siblings, and one grandparent would speak of their loss. When they were finished, Justice Eric Macklin said, "Let me just express my thanks and gratitude of all who did not know your loved ones. You've provided the court today, and I guess all of us, with a snapshot into what your children and your siblings have meant to you, and your families, and the community at large. Importantly, you've also expressed how your heartbreaking, immeasurable loss has deprived your family, your community, and society of their unrealized potentials, and the contributions each would have made. You've expressed the clearly deserved pride and love you have for them, so thank you. After the emotional statements, Dr. Alberto Choi, director for the Division of the Forensic Psychiatry Center at Alberta Hospital, testified. He said he believed that Matthew was not criminally responsible. He said that Matthew believed that the end of the world would take place that night, starting with a war, and that his victims were on the side of evil and were going to kill him. He said he believed that Matthew was suffering from a mental disorder at the time of the murders. He stated, "It appears that Mr. DeGroot had suffered from a psychotic episode. The disorganization and delusions identified at the time of the offence and his response to treatment would not be atypical of a severe psychotic disorder." He said that it was his professional opinion that Matthew was not able to determine that what he was doing was morally wrong, and genuinely believed that his victims were part of the other side of the war, who were supposed to attack him. He said he believed that Matthew suffered from a mental illness, but he couldn't ascertain if it were schizophrenia or something else. His testimony would be followed by Dr. Lenka Zedkova, who testified that she believed that Matthew was suffering from schizophrenia. She said Matthew believed that an end-of-the-world war was going to be waged against the sun god and the moon god. She said to the courtroom, "He started believing that they were going to kill him because he was the son of God." She said that Matthew had also told her that at some point at the party, he had heard a male demonic voice, which he attributed to the sun god telling him to kill them all before they killed him. And to Matthew, that signaled the end of the world. She said, "At the time of the stabbing, Mr. DeGroot was psychotic. He was experiencing psychotic symptoms." Dr. Andrew Hagg would be called to the witness stand. He said that he spoke with Matthew after he was sent to Alberta Hospital for a mental health assessment. He revealed he had asked Matthew what would have happened if there were more people inside the home when the attack unfolded. He replied that they too would have been killed. Much like the other two psychiatrists, Dr. Hagg had reached the same conclusion, that Matthew was suffering from a mental disorder, most likely schizophrenia, and had been experiencing multiple delusions at the time. All three of the psychologists had testified that they weighed the possibility that Matthew was malingering his psychotic symptoms to pursue a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, but all reached the same conclusion, that he was genuinely unwell. After the evidence was presented, it was time for closing arguments. In an almost unheard-of move, Prosecutor Weiberg said that he agreed that based on the evidence presented, Matthew was not criminally responsible for the murders. He said that although the murders had been committed with brutality and ruthless efficiency, he agreed that Matthew had suffered a psychotic episode. He stated, "I agree that the accused was suffering psychosis, which qualifies as a disease of the mind. I also agree on behalf of the probabilities that the accused was incapable of realizing his acts were morally wrong. The verdict of the trial would be decided by the judge, as opposed to a jury." Justice Eric Macklin would find Matthew DeGroot not guilty by reason of insanity. Defence Fay would read out a statement on behalf of Matthew. "I am truly and deeply sorry for this. I never intended for anything like this to happen. I feel the sorrow I have caused and will carry it for the rest of my life. I will control it by faithfully taking my medication and managing potential stressors. I will follow doctor's orders for the rest of my life." Outside of court, Matthew's father spoke with a congregation of media reporters.
"We accept the decision of the court. We will continue to walk by our son's side as together we travel the long and painful road ahead of us. Today is not the end of this tragic nightmare. We live it every day. We will continue to live it every day for the rest of our lives. Everyone connected with this tragedy can never forget the overwhelming heartache and suffering from the families of the victims. As we move forward, we will continue to keep the victims and their families in our prayers and hope that time will eventually begin to heal their pain and suffering. Thank you.
The not guilty verdict meant that Matthew would be kept in a secure psychiatric facility, pending assessment by the Alberta Review Board. Justice Eric Macklin would commend the family members of all of the victims for showing courage, dignity, and grace throughout the trial. Outside of court, Greg, who is Katie's father, said that they needed to accept the verdict, but said that the family members of the victims had now been given a life sentence. He stated, "It is not over. This isn't the end. Our life sentence is to every year go to the Mental Health Review Board and try to make sure this dangerous offender never gets out and has a chance to hurt anyone else." The following month, Matthew would be in court once again to talk about his detention and treatment. He publicly spoke for the very first time and apologized for his actions. He would be ordered to be kept in a secure psychiatric facility and have his case reviewed every year. The following year, Matthew would be granted new privileges by the Alberta Review Board. Escorted outings around the grounds of the Southern Alberta Forensic Psychiatry Centre and trips to Calgary for medical appointments. Family members of the victims would be in attendance and they didn't want the privileges to be granted. Joshua's father, Barclay, said, "I continue to question the value of dragging people through such an agonizing process under the guise of doing something that will actually have an impact." During the review in 2018, Matthew told the Alberta Review Board he suffered from survivor's guilt and that he was truly sorry for his actions. He said that he was taking his treatment very seriously and would be doing everything in his power to make amends. Family members of the victims jeered, as Matthew's psychiatrist said that he was a model patient. Just a couple of months later, Matthew was transferred to Alberta Hospital Edmonton. Then the following year, Matthew would be granted unsupervised outings in the Edmonton area to help him transition into a group home. In 2020, it was announced by the review board that while Matthew had been making progress, he would not be moved to the group home in the next year. He remains a patient at Alberta Hospital Edmonton. He is allowed unsupervised visits and is allowed to stay overnight at his parents' home. He continues to strive towards transitioning into a group home, and if things continue the way they have been, this will probably be granted within the next few years. It is a thought that terrifies the family members of his victims.
Our goal at the beginning of this trial was to put the spotlight on our loved ones, the family members that we lost. And that continues to be our goal now and into the future. We ask that everybody remember the names Zachary Rathwell, Jordan Segura, Katie Paris, Joshua Hunter, and Lawrence Hong. We can all cherish their legacy by reminiscing moments we had together, living out their values, and supporting others through the scholarships and the foundations created in their memory. These are the individuals who should be remembered. These are the lives that were lost. And no matter what, Katie, Jordan, Josh, Zach, and Lawrence are still gone. And our families will never be whole again. The end of this trial is not the end of the journey for us. We continue to be broken. The finding of NCR will be a recurring nightmare for our families. In this system, Matthew DeGroote will be meeting with the Mental Health Review Board every single year to determine if he will be granted concessions. There will be no peace for us. Our wounds will never fully heal, because every year our families will have to wonder what will be the fate of the man who destroyed so many lives.
On that fateful night in 2014, what should have been a quiet celebration turned into the epitome of an absolute nightmare. A group of young college students were at a party among friends, but that night, five of them didn't return home. Six if you count Matthew de Groot. His mental state had clearly been deteriorating, but nobody could have foreseen his actions that night. In the wake of the murders, the community wanted somebody to pay. They wanted justice to be served. During the trial, however, it quickly became apparent that Matthew was not of right mind. What makes it all the more poignant is that his psychosis had gone unspotted until it was much too late. In murder cases like this, it isn't an understatement to say that there truly are no winners. Matthew is left haunted by his actions that night, and the loved ones of his victims have been handed their own life sentence. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, a massive thank you for listening. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Lauren and Marley. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, ad-free and early release episodes behind the scenes, and much more. Could I also ask you guys a massive favour and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, The True Crime Witch. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Good evening, friends. I'm Emma, the host of the True Crime Witch podcast. Join me every other week as we delve into everything murderous, mysterious, and downright macabre. You can find the podcast by searching the True Crime Witch podcast on all of your favourite podcast apps and search for us on social media just using the True Crime Witch. Hope to see you there. Remember, friends, stay safe and stay spooky.